Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armitstead. Sometimes history creates unlikely heroes, and today's podcast features one of them. Mary Beard is a Cambridge classics professor whose robust love of Roman times, combined with a genuine respect for the Aristotelian ways of discourse, has made her a modern-day media star. History also has a way of repeating itself, and her celebrity means she follows the route of many in dividing opinion, regarded as both a standard bearer for reasoned debate and a legitimate target for particularly vicious Twitter trolls. Since conquering the small screen 8 years ago with the TV documentary Pompeii, her books, ranging from SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome, to her latest bestseller Women in Power, about the silencing of female voices across time, have made her a household name. Never one to rest on her laurels, her most recent television project, Civilizations, takes her around the world, reframing our understanding of the past in a 21st century successor to Kenneth Clark's classic 1969 BBC series Civilization. Mary joined our very own Charlotte Higgins at Sadler's Wells Theatre in London for a sold-out Guardian Live event. Using a mix of her own and audience questions, Charlotte began by asking, why is Kenneth Clark's view of civilization no longer applicable today?
That's quite a tough one in a way. I mean, I watched Kenneth Clark on Civilization. I was 14. And although everybody now says that Civilization was put on by the BBC to encourage us all to buy colour tellies, you know, colour telly was way out of reach of my family, I can tell you. And I watched it on a Radio Rentals flickery black and white telly, right, in 1969. And it, in some ways, opened my eyes and changed my life. And so, although I now feel quite distant, I think, rather than critical of, distant from Clark, I also feel terribly grateful. And everything, please remember that when I go on to be somewhat critical. I mean, I think if you watch it now, you just think, I can see why it was eye-opening, but despite what loads of people are saying, like, go back to the original Clark, it's brilliant, I think it's not close to unwatchable, but it seems like a period piece. Seems like watching Play for Today from the 1960s, you know, when, you know, which we remember with reverence. But if you ever find, you know, an issue of Play for Today, it's all wobbly sets and, you know, rather wooden acting. And Clark, in some ways, is analogous to that. And I mean, quite obviously, from the fact that it's entirely European, apart from one trip to America, as if somehow civilization could equate with Europe. And it only equated with the bits of Europe that he liked. He never went to Spain in this series. Never.
Velázquez was lost to him.
Nothing, right? But, you know, it's totally obvious, isn't it? You know, there's, you know, how many women are there in this 13-part series? Well, you know, the woman who has the most starring role is always the Virgin Mary, and there are plenty of Virgin Marys, but there's hardly a woman artist and hardly a woman patron. And you just think, this is a series which, I mean, I think in some ways was even a bit outdated in 1969. It just didn't recognise half the world who was both doing, consuming, patronising and looking at the art he was talking about. And he appeared, he was a lifelong Labour voter, and he was not quite the simple toff that he appeared. But it does feel like someone patrician orating at you. And that's not what I want to say about art anymore. It's not that I want to prevent anybody saying that. I'm a beneficiary of him. But, you know, you cannot talk about civilization as if it was Europe minus Spain. You just look mad, you know? Look completely bonkers, you know? And you cannot actually forget that, you know, the world is actually sunshine half female. You know, you may not, you know, the issue of how women have been brought in and out of the art world over the centuries that we talk about and that Clark talked about, you know, is an interesting and it's not a simple one, but it's not one you can look away from. It really isn't. Mm. And he also, I have to say, and this is rather personal, he started in the Middle Ages. You know, Clark occasionally had a little flashback to Greece and Rome, which he admired much, but he never actually thought, what is ancient art doing?
So he was speaking very much from, it was a very personal essayistic series, and he was not an expert in ancient art. Now, you are an expert in the ancient world and in the classical ancient world, and yet the addition of the S to civilization more or less demanded that you not stick to Europe, and indeed you very gamely disappear to Angkor Wat and to Mexico and to China and to Ely Cathedral, which is medieval, which was brilliant and looked huge fun, but presumably took you well out of your comfort zone. And I wonder how you sort of deal with... You are dealing in other people's cultures.
Yeah, and I think that it sounds very simple to say, all right, 1960s series, civilization, very limited. What do we do now? We shove an S on the end and off we go. And for about 5 minutes, I thought that was the case too. But I've come to see, I've been working on this series for about 3 years on and off, that putting an S on the end of civilization is only the beginning of the solution and the beginning of more problems. It's not, you don't solve the issue of cultural diversity just by taking a flight to Angkor Wat. If you want to think about how art operates, how it works, how it's seen and how it's used, you have to take into account a culturally diverse way of looking at the world, which, in the end, can't simply be represented by a sort of game old lady aged 63, who's a white classicist. So my problem was how you managed, in some ways, not to make the new series inadvertently as ethnocentric as the old series, but with a different version of ethnocentricity, And I thought there was a terrible danger that elderly white lady was going to seem to be claiming knowledge about anything she happened to want to talk about. And so I'll tell you here about the Greeks and the Romans, we'll get a whiz over to Mexico, and I'll tell you about the Olmec, and then we'll go to India, and then we'll go to mosques in Istanbul. And I think that what it... And I hope this has come over. I hope it's come over. It generated, for me, a desire to express some form of cultural humility. I learned a huge amount. Charlotte says, I gamely went. Well, I was very privileged to go, and I learned a lot from seeing things that I probably would never have seen before. But, I can't speak for the Olmec, but I can speak for why it is really important that we should look at them and think about them and how it challenges our own version of how we see things. People in the West have been extraordinarily well taught to see art in a particular way, even if they think they haven't been. Most of our childhood is a lesson in learning how to look at things. And it's a very, very cultural specific way of looking. And for me, I think, it's obviously, important, and it makes a much more engaging and, I think, imaginative series to spread much more widely than my comfort zone. But it also, for me, the point is that it challenges the very nature of a comfort zone.
Yeah. So it seemed to me that one of the ways you kind of got around that was by being very openly essayistic about that first episode and constructing an argument, which was partly about the Winkelmannian way in which we tend in the West to be kind of strongly attracted to that perfect Greek body, and that actually influences the way we value, say, the art of Mexico, or you might say of the Benin bronzes, or any number of non-Western, non-European artworks. It got quite a strong reaction. It got some real kickings in the reviews pages.
Yeah, and I think that's... I think we expected that. I think that it was a wonderful target. It was Tony Hall's pet project. If you could diss it, it was one of the best ways of dissing the licence fee. And there is a sense in which our view of Clark has become, it's a sanctified view of Clark. The idea that actually someone would seriously write in the Telegraph, this really makes Clark look a bit thin, that was never going to happen. right? But, you know, and I think, look, for heaven's sake, there are many things you could criticise about this series, and I hope, you know, the last thing I ever wanted to do in making my bits of it was have people actually admire it. I mean, I hope they'd enjoy it. But the idea that they'd say, wow, that was brilliant, turn the telly off and go to bed, that would have been a failure. And I really did want people to argue, to discuss, to say they didn't see it that way. And I wanted it to be interlocutory. And I have to say, Twitter has been amazing for talking about it to all kinds of people. It's been great.
It gets caught up in the culture wars, though, in a way, doesn't it? Because people like Quentin Letts in the Daily Mail, I mean, to an extent, Camilla Long in the Sunday Times, although it's quite hard to say that she had any critical purview at all.
Except
she only watched it for 20 minutes.
She did think my clothes were better than the last time on telly, and I must have borrowed them from somebody else. You know?
She's had a boil wash and is thankfully wearing somebody else's clothes. It is straight up gold-plated five-star nonsense, she said after 20 minutes viewing. But anyway, never mind. But in terms of the way other people... Quentin Letts and so on in the Daily Mail. There was a sense that, you know, that you're being fantastically politically correct, nonsense about... So you're kind of damned on both sides of that argument,
and
in a way.
It made me see more than I have often seen before, and maybe I've just been very blind, that there is a huge cultural investment in a view, particularly of ancient Greek and Roman culture, as somehow the touchstone of what, quotes, Western civilization is, that I and my students haven't adhered to for decades. And I think the one thing that really struck me, you know, apart from Quentin Letts saying that I'd said that Praxiteles the sculptor was a rapist, which was, he can't have watched it, he must have just whizzed through. When we talk, as I do, about the Greek image of the body and how important that is, it seemed to us, and this is not, I have to say, you know, this is, you know, there are my views in here, but this is very much a team effort when you make a television programme. And this was hugely discussed and bashed out with the director, and the sound man, the executive producer, the cameraman. We're all involved in talking about this. At a certain point, we thought, we've just got to say, look, this wonderful image of the Greek body that we have inherited was actually a very exclusionary image. You know, that the cult of the beautiful and good man, the kalos kai agathos in Greek terms, was a cult which actually excluded the foreigners, the barbarians, the fat, the old, the, you know, the flabby, and so forth. And in one sentence I said, look, just don't fall for this. You know, not all Greeks were gorgeous in these terms. The number of reviews that have said that Mary Beard claims the Greeks were fattest is unbelievable.
Well, they kind of were, weren't they?
It's about the least interesting thing that you can say about them. And she says it in one sentence to point to an say, look, these people are really interesting, but there's stuff about them you're not going to like. You know, let's look again at the women and the slaves. One bit that didn't get in, perhaps I've been rescued from it being in, because it would have, you know, it also would have been in the headlines. You know, this is a culture in which no woman was counter-civilized. This was a culture that completely excluded women from the cultural transmission of art, literature, and culture. And somehow, I mean, you've just got to look at this straight. You've got to face up to this. That doesn't mean that you stop admiring or being interested in Greek art, literature and culture and all the rest. Of course, I've spent my blasted life doing it. But unqualified and simply kind of passive admiration makes the Greeks much less interesting than they really were. Mm. Blimey.
Did you at any point... Did you at any point define civilization for yourself? Self-defined, uncivilized. What do you consider civilization to
I think
to
it's always of? An antagonistic term. You know, one thing that I certainly say in the book, and I think say somewhere in the film, you know, one man's civilization is another man's barbarity. And, you know, I think it's terribly, terribly important to remember that to other people, we look barbarous, right? And you know, this is not, there isn't anybody in the world who goes around and saying, I'm barbarous and those guys over there are civilized. You know, it is only a self-defining term. And I'm currently making a, I am going to give this away, although I shouldn't. I'm making a final episode of Civilizations about the art that you can see in this country, particularly in this country. That's partly because, you know, Charlotte suggested the, you know, the series is very far flung, and you know, the idea that you come away with the impression that you needed to get a long haul flight to Cambodia before you could enjoy any of this stuff was wrong. And so we're looking at art, Civilizations on your doorstep. But we went to the V&A the other day to film a most amazing and really instructive 18th century, late 18th century woodcut, Japanese woodcut. And it's of a European, probably a Dutchman, with a Japanese, quotes, prostitute. And the Japanese prostitute is lovely and absolutely elegantly clad, looking human. And the Dutchman, if it's a Dutchman, is like a, is a monster. He's got kind of claws for his fingers. He's shaggy. His tongue is red. He's kind of, he's half on the way to being animal. And they both have sort of speech bubbles coming out of their mouths. And the animaline barbarous Dutchman is, I don't read Japanese, but apparently is speaking complete nonsense down one side. Just like the Greeks imagined the barbarians
to speak. Right, bar, 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 bar.
So he's going bar, 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 bar. And the prostitute is saying, I haven't a clue what you're saying, but please get on with it. Now, that, you know, there is civilization versus barbarity in a nutshell.
Right. Well, I mean, talking of the... I mean, I can't not kind of... You know, I'm not going to go into Jeremy Paxman mode, but I can't... Talking of the fact that civilized is a contested term, you did drop into a bit of trouble recently, did you not, when you tweeted about the business in Haiti? And just to remind you, I'm sorry if this is painful, but I'm going to do it anyway.
This is what the interviews were like.
You tweeted, of course, one can't condone the alleged behaviour of Oxfam staff in Haiti and elsewhere, but I do wonder how hard it must be to sustain civilised, in quotes, values in a disaster zone. And overall, I still respect those who go in to help out where most of us would not tread. Now, that tweet disappointed a lot of people, actually, who normally would be kind of on your... I mean, colleagues in Cambridge. There was a sense that you had... You were kind of complicit in an othering of Haitian people. I mean, I know you there was no agency given to Haitian people in that tweet and so on.
When you offend people in a tweet, when you didn't mean to... You know, I'm capable of meaning to offend people sometimes. But in this case, that was not remotely what I wanted to do. So you have to say something has gone wrong, and it must partly be you. If you offend people when you didn't intend to, that's not a very cute method of communication or a productive one. I think one thing that, that is totally obvious there is that, as you can tell from the way we've been talking, I've been spending 3 years talking and problematising the idea of civilised. And when I put civilised in inverted commas, there's a whole lot of baggage that goes with that, of the sort that we've just touched on. Now, I know about Twitter well enough for it to have been completely stupid of me to put civilised in inverted commas and to think that the average reader of Twitter would get what I was talking about.
Yeah, they'd have to mind read.
They would have to mind read. For me, it was just a shorthand, which I thought was self-evident. I don't believe anybody's civilized. You know, I think we all like to think we are, but we could go down that route forever. But how stupid not to realize that mere scare quotes do not get seen on Twitter. I mean, I think apart from that, however, and where I would stand up for myself is that we don't really know what went on, but if it's anything like what was said, how could you possibly condone it? What would it be like to be the sort of person who said, yeah, great, I think that's a jolly good idea? Of course not. I mean, absolutely, I find that slightly insulting. But I do think, and I've got into trouble for this before, and I shall go on getting into trouble for it until I die, that I think we do have to try to explain things and understand things, and that explaining things and understanding things is not the same as approving them or letting them off the hook or condoning it. You know, I kind of think, you know, I spend my life getting students, for example, to explain why Nero persecuted Christians. Now, I'm not expecting them to give him a pat on the back, you know?
And go
not
off and persecute some Christians.
Well done, you know? Of course I'm not. Mm. But if we want to stop things happening, if we really want to stop things happening, we've got to understand why they do. And simply human wickedness is not a good enough explanation. And I want as much as anybody, I think, to stop people being exploited, etc., etc., wherever it is and whatever. But you know, unless you understand why that's happening, then I think that you put back the solution by decades.
Mm. Nevertheless, you were accused of genteel racism. There's a sort of sense that you had, you know, you'd othered this thing called the disaster zone.
You had to be careful there, because genteel racism, I think no white person in this country knows quite how racist they are. We live in a structure of racism, and to say I'm not racist doesn't mean anything. I mean, it can mean you're not like Alf Garnett, but still, you know, but that's not saying very much, because the structures of the way we live, we're probably, any white person is probably to some extent, genteelly or not genteelly, racist. Just like, you know, let me just go a bit further here. In some ways, you might say that we are all, to a degree, sexist. That we live in a culture where those structures operate, so we can't possibly not be. Disaster Zone was another thing I suppose I should... You know, I regret, because I meant it absolutely literally. You know, this was a country in which 250,000 people had just been killed by an earthquake. It was a disaster. I suddenly realised that this was... People saw it in the kind of terms of Trump's basket case.
Yeah, shitholes.
Shithole. Kind yeah. of, you know, I meant that this was, we were 250,000 dead and we were in the middle of a cholera epidemic introduced actually by UN troops. So it appears, so the UN have now admitted. Now, you know, in a strict letter of the law, that to me is a disaster zone. It's a disaster zone, whether it's in Haiti, whether it's in Edinburgh, whether it's in Saffron Walden, Iran, or whatever. And I think that I still feel, I mean, of course, if anybody thinks I really condone sexual violence and exploitation of women and children, then we can meet outside and talk about it.
No. But I think there was a slightly more sophisticated argument about the way Westerners frame disaster zones. Yeah.
But I would frame Edinburgh. I would frame, if that happened to Edinburgh, if there was an earthquake in Edinburgh.
Right.
Pompeii was a disaster zone. Mm. I mean, okay, you can interrogate the terms, but. I don't quite know what you'd say. I mean, I don't quite see why disaster zone in this case. It's not like saying, you know, blimey, you know, Shrewsbury's a disaster zone these days, isn't it, where I come from, you know, with that derogatory sense. If Shrewsbury has had a massive kind of flood, it might be literally a disaster zone. And I have to say, with all kind of modesty or self-awareness, I stay away from disaster zones. You know, when there's an earthquake in some place, I don't go there. Mm. And I, you know, that's just because that's where I and most of us are happy Westerners, where we can avoid that kind of thing. And I feel admiration for people. And they're not just, you know, I'm afraid the aid industry is not any longer just, you know, good boys and girls on their blasted gap years. You know, these are professional people from all over the world. They're not just Western, they're not just European, and they're not just white. And they go to places when, you know, there are still, most of those 250,000 bodies are still unburied. And you know, I have to say, I do not condone what they necessarily do in those circumstances. I want to try to understand why that happened. I want to punish them, because that deserves punishment. But I also have to recognise that that's not the kind of place I go.
Yeah.
I have to, you know, there's a bit of humility here. You know, there's lots of other things I wouldn't do. I wouldn't go into space. You know, I'm a coward, you know. And most of us are cowards. And I think cowards should just be a little bit careful before they leap too enthusiastically to a certainty of moral judgment.
Yeah.
Maybe that was too complicated to get onto a tweet.
Yes.
In which case, you know, bang to rights, I'm guilty. I'm guilty of trying to be a bit nuanced on Twitter, but I shall go on trying to be for as long as Twitter exists.
I mean, part of me, I mean, I'm not, don't want to talk about Haiti anymore, but the Twitter, I still sort of feel, I mean, I was on Twitter before you were, and I remember you asking me about it, and I was saying, God, well, you know, I have to be on it, but if you can avoid it, you know, do. I just wonder whether it's the medium as the message in this particular case, and actually there's a reason that your nuance was lost on Twitter, and that is because it is 280 characters. Yeah, it's particularly suited to Donald Trump talking crap. It is not particularly suited to Professor Mary Beard trying to say something interesting.
That may be the case, and it certainly, it tends to the assertive rather than the nuanced mode. But actually, if we're going to give up, if we're just going to give up on things like Twitter and just leave it to warring parties shouting at each other from equal positions of moral certainty, then I think that's a bit irresponsible. You know, I am not in a one-woman campaign to make Twitter more nuanced. That would be stupid. But, you know...
Well, be doomed.
But, you know, be doomed. But I think that we can do something. We can say, hang on, don't rush so quickly. Now, sometimes when I say don't rush so quickly, actually, it has a positive effect. Sometimes it does. And if always I tried vainly to put my hand up and make a nuanced but obviously completely doomed point about some issue of extreme moral certainty in the community, you know, if every time I ended up in a kind of shit pile like I did, I would give up. I mean, actually, it comes and it goes, and you stick in there. Mm. You know, Twitter for me is more good than it's bad. I get a pylon from time to time. But if you kind of look at it overall, I've got more good out of it, and more support, and more friends than the reverse. Mm. And I think that, you know, to go back to civilizations, one of the things that's really most fun now when you make a television programme is you sit there and you've got the telly on and you've got your iPhone out. You know, and people tweet and they say, God, what's that that she's showing us? And you tweet back. And suddenly, television becomes an entirely different way, and largely thanks to Twitter, it becomes interactive. People say, oh, I didn't agree with that. And you say, no, I was a bit worried. I think it came over a bit crudely. And you can have, well, one of the BBC execs watching this said, God, it was like a seminar on Twitter. And it was just great fun to engage directly with people who watch your programmes as they're watching it. It's wonderful. I mean, in the old days, before I ever did any telly, I believe that you might have, you know, after about 2 weeks, got a handwritten letter from, you know, a couple of people who wanted to say, I much enjoyed your transmission on this, right? And you would write, go nicely back. You know, now they're saying, God, that's good, and you can, or the reverse, it's not all positive, of course, but you're there actually talking to people as it happens in a community. It's wonderful. Really like it.
So I have one final question that touches on the idea of civilization, and it's two audience questions that I'm shoving together, because I had two audience questions that were really quite anxious about civilization and whether we were reaching the end of it, or whether it was threatened. And I think, you know, help us out here.
Well, I think
there are some worried people out there.
Insofar as civilization is more than a state of mind, and I'm not quite sure how far more than a state of mind it is, insofar as it's more than that, or even as that, you know, it's worried always about two things. One of the things it's worried about is where did my civilization start? So it's always looking for its myths of origin, how we became civilized against other people. But also it's always predicting its own end. Civilization, insofar as that's a kind of term of self-description, is also always imminently foreseeing that it is not going to last much longer. There's a kind of strange sort of combination of nostalgia and anxiety for the future, and that goes back as far as you can see. And one of my favourite incidents from Roman history is in the 2nd century BC, where Scipio is fairly brutishly, actually, well, not fairly brutishly, appallingly, with appalling violence, is destroying the city of Carthage. It's the end of the war of Rome against Hannibal, and Scipio has gone out basically to torch the city really gruesomely. And he's got his pet historian with him, Polybius. And we have much of Polybius' account of this. Polybius notices that Scipio is standing there. He's quoting a line from Homer's Iliad about how Troy goes up in flames, and he's crying. And Polybius, rather dumbly actually, says, "Why are you crying, Scipio?" And Scipio says, "That'll happen to Rome one day," basically. And indeed it did. You know, indeed it did. And there's a wonderful drawing, if you ever go to that marvellous John Soane Museum, not far from here. There's a wonderful drawing by Soane's excellent, brilliant draftsman, Joseph Gandhi. And it's a drawing of the future. And there's the River Thames, very obviously, and London is in ruins.
The Bank of England as well. Jones designs for the Bank of England, but in the as a future ruin.
Yeah.
Ballard, eat your heart out.
That's right. And here, it's just in the same cabinet as the Bank of England, same frame. You've got the ruins of London, and on the bank of the river, there is a New Zealander sitting, sketching them. You know, the point being, you know, that just as we trot off to Italy to sketch the ruins of Rome, one day the furthest colonial that you could imagine will be here with his sketchbook sketching the ruins of us. You know, and I think civilization is partly about knowing you're not going to last.
Yeah.
Or fearing you're not going to last.
Yes. And I suppose that is a very strong stream in Roman thought, actually, come to think of it, isn't it? When, you know, Virgil, Aeneid 8, Aeneas is being taken on this tour guide's tour of the future site of Rome, many, many generations hence, and what he's shown are ruins of an older
civilization.
I mean, so it's like the decline of Rome is kind of immanent in that futuristic vision.
Yeah.
It's a very strange passage.
And it is, there is nothing modern about those anxieties and worries about the relationship between us and the end and the ruin, the past and the future. It's actually absolutely, it's one of the things that, in a sense, we, if not in, I think it's wrong to say inherit from, because that kind of somehow implies something too passive, but we've partly learned about from our engagement with the classical past.
Which leads us to segue rather neatly into more firmly into the Roman world and the world of classics, which is, you know, the centre of your professional life, of course. One of the things that I found really, really, really interesting when we were talking together for the piece and also when I was talking to colleagues of yours about what it is that, what is your thing, that what is your modus operandi, not to make you sound like a serial killer, but what is your what is your modus operandi as a historian? And you didn't say this to me, but Greg Wolfe, who's a professor at the University of London, said it to me. He said, what Mary makes us do is see that we can't look through a window into Rome and see exactly what it's like. She doesn't believe that that is possible. What she believes in is the texts that tell us about what happened in Rome, and they kind of form a window. And what we can do is look at the window. We can look at the texts that tell us about Rome, but we can't ever kind of feel ourselves fully into the place. And your historical kind of method. The other thing he said was that it was like it was almost as if you reversed the footnotes of the text. So if you're reading a linear piece of narrative history and it will say, you know, on the Ides of March, Julius Caesar was assassinated, it will tell you a story. And the footnotes will say, you know, blah, blah, blah told us that, in Suetonius it says that this happened, and in Plutarch it says that this happened, and that's how we know that Julius Caesar was assassinated on the Ides of March. But you almost reverse that, so you are kind of unpicking what Plutarch is telling us, what Suetonius is telling us.
I think that's true. I mean, it's not that... No, I am going to confess to occasional feelings of fantastic closeness to ancient Rome.
Well, I'm stopping you from speaking, but I suppose what I really also wanted to ask you was, is it not slightly disingenuous... I mean, do you not actually think to yourself, this is what it was like to be, you know, at that point on the Ides of March, watching this unfold? I mean, do you have the sort of historical imagination that sneakily allows you to put yourself in those places?
I think that any historian who says that they never, ever wonder what it might have been like to be there is telling you a lie. Right? It would be impossible, I think, to spend a whole working life working on the ancient world and never, you know, having completely kept out of your mind what it would actually be like to be there. And so, of course, you think that sometimes. And, of course, you know, I'm not going to deny that if you... Well, even just picking a Roman coin out of the soil, you know, I still sometimes get a thrill if I do that. I still love touching the ancient world. You know, I think more people should be encouraged and allowed to touch the ancient world.
That was very clear in the civilizations when you were with the statue of Memnon, for example, looking at that Greek verse written by that lady.
You know, just get there, you know, physical contact. I mean, you know, the whole British public has got far too impressed by the idea of putting on plastic gloves before they touch anything that might be over 100 years old. It's completely barking. It really is. You know, the colossi of Memnon are not going to be remotely damaged by beard climbing up them, or many others, frankly. And it's fun. You know, I think there is something great to think. I'm touching something that the people touched. When you go to Pompeii, I don't know how many people here have been to Pompeii, but you see people's pleasure there when they go over the stepping stones across the streets in Pompeii. And that's partly because they know they're standing in the footsteps of Romans and others who've done that before. There's a direct connection. It's great fun, and it means something to me, and it's one of the things that keeps me interested. But I think that you have to stop yourself being naive about that kind of connection. It can be fun, but most of the way that we understand about the distant past is mediated by all kinds of complexities about who wrote what and who chose to preserve what and how people in the 19th century read this and how we now read it. And in some ways, that dialogue across the millennia between us and them is, for me, not just as interesting as the connection with the past, but in some ways it's what history is about. And it's one of the things that I've been really, really keen to get, you know, onto television, because I think that popular history in this country has often been somehow looked on as if it was a different kind of history. The last thing you want to do, if you want to get 1.5 million viewers, don't bother them about the problems that there are in understanding this. Just give them a good story, you know, and if possible, get people dressed up in silly clothes and pretending to be Romans, but B-list actors, right? Okay. Now, actually, I hope I've been a little bit successful. I think there's room for different sorts of history. But I think I've been a little bit successful in saying, look, people who watch these television programs are not stupid. And what people are interested in is how you know something, as much as what you know. How do we know about the Romans? Not, you know, they don't want to sit and listen to a lecture in which nobody says how, they just say what. And so I've been very, very keen always to stress the way the dialogue works between us and them. Now, you have to be a bit careful. If, and I am rather liable to do this and I have to be stopped, if you spend the first 10 minutes of a television programme saying, now, we don't know anything about this and we don't know anything about that, I don't know that, you know, it can be a bit of a downer, right? You know, people will think, oh, shit, let's turn onto a programme where somebody does know something, you know, right? But in a sense, you want to get I do want to get over what we can know and what we can't, and what the limits of knowledge are. And, you know, I don't know can usually be turned into something a bit more upbeat. I don't know. Right, we try, anyway.
Do you think I'm wrong in suggesting that you have become slightly less cautious over the years, in as much as, and I just wonder whether it is to do with being bullied by TV producers. I think there was slightly more positive statement of stuff actually having happened in SBQR than there is potentially in Pompeii, for example.
In the books, I think it is hard, because I say, you know, going from telly to a book, a long run of I don't knows or we don't know, and it's synonyms. You know, it's not exactly a come on. But I mean, I think that if you go to something like SPQR, there the way I got round the I don't knows was by saying, look, actually, spin that on its head, and let's think actually a bit more clearly about what we do know. But let's concentrate on what we do know. Mm-hmm. Let's not ask questions that we simply can't answer. And if you concentrate on what you do know, you get a story, but it's a different story. I mean, it's like, I mean, a very simple example is the origins of Rome. If you say, how did the city of Rome start? The true answer to that is we don't know. We have no idea. We can be pretty certain that it was a pretty nasty one-horse dump for many centuries, but we don't know. And the archaeology that there is deeply contested. If you say, how did the Romans think their city start? Then you can take, there's loads of stories. They're not true. You know, Romulus and Remus didn't exist. Neither did Aeneas. None of those are true. But if you look at them and you look at what the Romans said, you do see in those stories an enormous amount of stuff about how the Romans saw themselves.
They reveal themselves through their own kind of self-mythologizing, self-historicizing.
So you
detect that, something that comes out very strongly is this sort of sense that the city is founded in fratricide and kind of cemented by rape.
And that's telling you, the first Roman marriage is rape. It is the rape of the Sabine women. Romulus has founded his city. He hasn't got enough women. He thinks, oh, blimey, I've got loads of men, but this is going to be a rather short-lived city, right, if we don't get some women. And so they invite the locals to a festival, and in the kind of bowdlerized translations, they run off with the women, right? Run off with. Oh, yeah, they rape the women. And that, as the Romans repeatedly say, is the first Roman marriage. Now, actually, I think the Romans were rather good at looking at some of their social, cultural, and gender problems in the face, and they debated about the rape of the Sabine women and what that said about Roman marriage. They also debate about the very nature of civil war. You know, if you live in a city in which you have two founders, and on the very day of the foundation, one of the founders kills his twin brother, you know, you're saying something about what your city's about. Similarly, and slightly,
particularly if it's ruled by two consuls and a senate. Yeah.
And similarly, I think, and this is, we find this a rather more positive version, but it's not clear the Romans would have done. Way before he suddenly kind of twigs that there's a woman shortage in Rome, Romulus has also got a person shortage. He looks around and he's got, you know, a band of about 10 shepherds, and that's not going to make a city either. So he says, my city will be an asylum, that runaway slaves can come here, foreigners can come here, criminals come here. This is a place of asylum. And Romulus's city is founded as a place where anybody on the earth can come. Now, as I say, we find that a rather charmingly liberal notion. I think that the ancient Romans would probably find that as difficult as the idea that it was found
out. It was pragmatic, wasn't it? Because Rome continues to self-perpetuate by being a place that people can come to, and you can become Roman in a way that you couldn't become Athenian.
That's right. And so if you say, all right, you know, to go back to the how did Rome start, we haven't the foggiest, but we know what they said, we can trace in ample detail what literate male Romans, at least, said about how their city started, and that's telling us a hell of a lot about how they thought about themselves as a community. And I think that, in a sense, what I was trying to do in SBQR was to kind of embrace that and to say, let's think about what we know. Let's think about what we do know and squeeze it. Rather than, I mean, classicists and ancient historians are kind of, you know, can be a bit of a gloomy crowd, actually. And there is a certain temptation for them to say, right, what do we know about the origin of the city of Rome? Well, there's loads and loads of myth. We can't believe that. Throw them away. There's a little bit of archaeology, deeply contested. Throw that away. And you're left with just a black hole. And what I'm trying to do is say, look hard at what you've got and ask it slightly different questions, and you'll find you know loads of things.
This touches on a question from an audience member, what I'm about to ask, which is about the other end of the Roman Empire. Were the Romans self-conscious in any way about the decline, the end of the Roman Empire? Did they feel it disappearing? I mean, you know, what's going on there?
Well, we don't know, because they've always been feeling it disappearing.
Right.
I've recently found myself much more interested in why they got an empire in the first place than why they lost it in the end. But I think we've got to be a bit realer about it than we usually are, which is to say, well, they didn't lose it in the East, right? Up till the 15th century, there was a Roman Empire. We call it the Byzantines. But the Byzantines called themselves the Romans. They thought of, they were Romans. So my husband's a Byzantinist, and whenever I talk about the decline of the Roman Empire, he'll always say, in the West. And he's right, he is right. I think that what is going on in the West is, you know, thanks to Gibbon, it's become one of modern history's great conundrums. But we have inherited an extraordinary 19th century version of what happens to the Roman Empire in the West, you know, which is, you know, you can see it in 19th century painting after painting. You know, there you've got, you know, the wonderful Roman architecture and sculpture, and, you know, there's some nasty barbarians, and here we are back to the civilization and barbarity, you know, with kind of beards and torques around their neck and shaggy hair, looking like my Dutchman from the Japanese painting, and they're tearing everything down, and they're thuggish, and they're called things like vandals, you know, all right, and, you know, they are about to destroy everything that Rome had stood for.
It's kind of the start of Kenneth Clark's civilization, in fact.
Yeah, we got through by the skin of our teeth because there were all these awful, awful blokes around. And there might have been some of that, you know, heaven knows. But if you go and look at actually what these barbarian kingdoms were doing, they were busy writing Latin poetry. Vandal poetry in Africa is some of the most important poetry of the 5th and 6th centuries AD. They were recodifying Roman law, and what they, in a sense, what had happened, whatever conflict there might be in terms of, you know, the occasional battle in a city, in basically the endemic violence of the ancient world, basically, Rome has kind of diversified. It's a kind of, it's a, you might, if you were being very, very, very liberally upbeat here, you might see the end of the Roman Empire as kind of devolution on a mammoth scale. Right?
I was going to say, are we not being slightly guilty here of that kind of, I mean, I feel very guilty of this myself, thinking, you know, I mean, you know, it was just a wonderful cross-fertilisation. You know, people were slaughtered, you know, there were some...
always been slaughtered in the ancient world, though. They've always been slaughtered.
They were used to it.
They're used to it, yes, they're used to it. But, you know, actually, to be a bit more serious, one of the big debates that still rages in the history of late antiquity is whether it's this kind of slightly liberal devolutionary process that I've been, you know, a bit egging, I have to say. Charlotte's quite right to stop me do it too much. Or a kind of slightly milder version of the, you know, the thugs and the barbarians and the vandals destroying things. And that is still debated, the debate about what cities do, how a civilization that's built on urbanness continues or not. And you started off talking about civilization and barbarity. Well, in a sense, it's, you know, one of the places where we find it hardest to agree, you know, even within the study of the ancient world itself, about what counts as barbarous, is what's going on in what we call the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. You know, and there are the arguments of all sorts. They're cultural. You know, I will throw in Vandal poetry and somebody else will counter and say, you can't have a civilization without a water supply, though, right? And so you get a material. You know, what happens to the aqueducts? Can you still go to a flushing loo in 6th century BC? There would be people who would say, look, you know, that actually there is a material basis to this, which if it goes, you know, this is worse. But, you know, I don't... Charlotte's too worried about people getting in the ancient world, seeing there are some periods when more people get killed than others. The ancient world is throughout a brutal, terrifying, bloody place.
So I have one audience question saying, where would you rather be in October 79 AD? Vesuvius,
oh,
London or Rome?
Oh, God.
None of the above.
None of the above. I mean, there is a kind of question, and again, one enjoys these fantasy questions, yeah. You know, about, you know, which period of history would you like
to go back to? I'm going to give you a cloak of invisibility and a full stock of antibiotics.
And a return ticket.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the important thing.
No, we want you back.
Go back to the ancient world if I've got the return ticket, right?
Where, just to rephrase it, where, if you could, under these very special conditions, go anywhere, where would it be at any time? What would you most like to spy on?
I'd like to spy on what really happened in a Roman bath.
Men's Day or Women's Day?
Men's Day.
I'm not sure, I'm just making that up. Did they have different days?
They sometimes have special hours for women. Right. Mixed bathing may occasionally have happened, but was very, very outre.
Right. Right. So
mostly
what
they were
do you
separate.
Want to see, in particular, see, in the men's baths?
I want to see how it all works. I mean, you know, the baths is one of those places where modern... Yeah, and in fact, some of the best side of modern education, particularly for kids, has kind of normalised it. You say, so, what did the Romans do in the afternoon? Well, they would go to the baths, and they would go in, and they would go to the counter, and they would get a towel from the attendant. They would then go to the changing room. That's called the apodyterium, by the way. And they would put their clothes in a locker. Occasionally, they had to mind out for pickpockets, because the baths were a place. And then, of course, they would move into probably the tepidarium, the warm room, or perhaps going through the cold room first. And, of course, we've got to think about this as a kind of sort of golf club, rotary club, and gym all rolled into one. It's kind of thing. This is really social life. You've seen hundreds of school textbooks that say this. Now, I want to go and I want to see how seedy it is, how sordid it is, how filthy. I want to interview the girl who has presumably got other duties other than giving the towels out, I bet. I want to see whether you always had to go round in this way. First, I must go to the apodyterium, and then I'm going to miss out the frigidarium, and I'll go straight to the tepidarium, and then I'm going to sweat it out in the sudarium. And all of this, I think, is a fantasy of modern history. And I want to go back, and I want to show that to be true.
Well, actually, if you read early modern accounts of the baths, the Roman baths at Bath, which were a going concern, you know, in a slightly different form, and it's exactly as you suggest, you know, there was poo floating around in the water, there were people bathing their kind of syphilitic wounds, and it was scattered with prostitutes.
One Roman doctor says, if you've got an open wound, in his writing giving advice, if you've got an open wound, don't go to the baths, because you'll die.
Well, as long as you've got those antibiotics with you for this trip, we'll let you go and hope that you report back.
Frankly, I'd rather stay where I am.
I have another really interesting audience question, which is about the status of classics, in that, you know, classics is, you know, lots of people are interested in it, and that's a really wonderful thing, and your books and TV programmes have been a big part of that. But on the other hand, it is, you know, departments of classics are under pressure in universities, and some have closed. There are just numerically fewer schools teaching Latin and Greek. What do you think, you know, I think the question actually said, is classics doomed?
This is a bit like civilization question, because classics, I think since about 200 AD, has thought it was doomed, you know. The Romans thought they were worse than those that came before. And I remember once when I was doing a little bit of work on how classics was taught in Cambridge in the late 19th century, the time which I assumed, and which we still do assume, was the great glory days of classical education, you know, when people could, you know, translate, you know, Euripides well, even Thucydides at sight. They didn't, you know, the fact that they were poor little overprivileged but undereducated public school boys who'd done nothing but Latin and Greek since they were seven, well, that was one side of it, but it was still in our modern mythology, it was when people really knew Latin and Greek. I went to look at the kind of debates that were being had in Cambridge at the time for how to teach it, and I found they were even gloomier than we are. They kept saying, oh, they don't know that they don't know their Greek like they used to. And when they founded, in the beginning of the 20th century, they founded what is now a very august institution called the Classical Association. It was founded because they thought they had to get together and save the subject. Now, I think classics changes. I mean, of course, Charlotte, you're right that there are, you know, austerity doesn't make for a very good education policy, and there are schools where classics teachers are heroically struggling on to keep Latin and Greek and classical studies on the curriculum. There are other places, both in schools and universities, where it has been at least temporarily chopped. And yeah, of course, I deplore that. But I think there's also an optimistic side. I mean, there, you know, there are enormous strides being made at reintroducing Latin. Classics for All, for example, is a charity which funds the reintroduction of particularly Latin to maintain schools. And there are thousands upon thousands of people who are learning about classics in some way. Many more than used to. I mean, I think our nostalgia is a very sort of classist nostalgia, honestly. When we think about how people used to know Latin and Greek, you know, really well, and they were imbued with it, and they kind of, they commanded the classical world, that was a tiny minority of toffs who did that. Mm. Wasn't everybody. People like me didn't command the classical world 150 years ago. And the idea that now that there are, it's not a boy's subject only, and that it's not just a tough subject. And of course, it's, you know, there are things to fight about. There are things we've got to, you know, we've got to be watchful. But, you know, if somebody says, "Do you think there'll still be classics departments thriving in this country in 100 years' time?" I will, without hesitation, put my money on it.
Do you think that classics can or should survive the fact that it has this weight of inherited cultural supremacy, the fact that it has this baggage of being, you know, the establishment? So do you think it's right? Do you think it's right that should break down or be challenged?
That's all the more reason for it to survive, because what we're engaged with is reinventing the subject. The subject is always being reinvented. You know, and any subject that's kept going this long is always being kept going in a different form. But, you know, what we need to do, and I think this is really important, is we need precisely to challenge that view of classics. You know, but so the idea that somehow, that if we just let it die gracefully, that somehow we could then get on and study something that wasn't so ridden in terms of British male class politics, I think is mad. I mean, in some ways, again, to go back to civilizations, I think the outcry about fatism that greeted me saying that, you know, the Greeks weren't all lithe, slim, supple bodies, and they excluded the other, the foreign, the barbarian, the old, etc. That outcry shows precisely how we need to get people to see that there is no legitimacy and authority in a particular version of a comfortable white civilization in the classical world. You know, it shows us all our problems, all the ways that we make fudges about who we are and who the barbarian is, and we need to study it all the more because of the way it was for a while appropriated. You know, what better way to kind of police entry to the governing class than to make all the little boys learn a language that no one speaks? Yeah. You know, perfect.
There is a certain amount of current anxiety that this subject is sort of being lassoed, brought into the fold of the white centre far right in America, that is causing a lot of anxiety among classicists in America. The real politics of this apparently, Western centric, European centric subject.
I'm afraid there is one thing is true, we've got to accept it, that nobody and no political group owns the ancient world. Well, no, it's not for me to police how it is studied. I can show you how I think it ought to be studied, and I can try to convince you that extremely conservative, sometimes bordering on white supremacist argument is wrong. But I don't own it, and the idea that classics is the possession, as ever should ever be the possession, you can't own history, you can only talk about it. I worry sometimes about the view of the extreme right, both in this country and America. And I think, to go back to a very different version of a Twitter storm that I had, just to show that it's not always dangerously on the pro-colonial side. The last one I had before that was when I defended a BBC cartoon which showed a person of colour as governor of Roman Britain, which is undoubtedly unsurprising, quite possible, plausible, and utterly historically reasonable. Now, the amount of piling I got over that by people who, it seemed to me, did not want to acknowledge that there were any people of colour in this country until about 1950 was extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I think that you have to fight and fight and fight and say, look, you know, we have a sub-Saharan African Roman skeleton here. Right? Just get real. Face this.
Go to York Museum and
get
see it.
Get real. I also think, however, the alt-right has become something of a fantasy bogey for, you know, liberal classicists. And they'd always think, oh my God, the alt-right is taking over our subject. The alt-right is probably a few spotty boys in their mum's attic late at night with a computer. You know, there's one or two very nasty guys out there, but mostly they're spotty boys, I think.
Mary Beard was speaking with Charlotte Higgins at a Guardian Live event at Sadler's Wells in London. For more information about being in the audience at future events, go to membership.theguardian.com/events. Next week, we'll be meeting up with Lisa Halliday, whose clever debut novel has set literary tongues wagging with its portrayal of a May-to-December affair not so dissimilar from one she herself had in her 20s with one of America's greatest novelists. In the meantime, please subscribe and review us on all your favourite podcatchers and join the discussion on Twitter or by leaving a comment on the podcast page. Or if you prefer to contact us directly, you can email us at bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.